Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Women Arsecast on arseblog.com, coming at you this week with not one but two full episodes. That's right, we're looking ahead to the Tokyo Olympics, which kick off later this month, and obviously specifically the women's football tournament. Plenty of Arsenal interest therein. We'll have, I think, nine players overall across four teams, and those are the four teams we're going to look at in this two-part episode. In this episode, we will look at and talk about with some very distinguished guests who've been on the podcast before. We'll talk with Samantha Lewis, our expert on all things Australia and Matildas. And obviously, Arsenal have three players in the Matildas squad for the Tokyo game. So we'll talk to Samantha a bit about Australia's chances, what's been happening with the Matildas over the last 18 months, because things have been a little bit crazy for them with the situation. And obviously, we'll talk specifically about Caitlin Ford, Steph Catley and Lydia Williams. And then in part two, Alex and I will be talking to Anne-Marie Posmer, who is also, I think, making her second appearance on the podcast. And she is our expert on all things Netherlands. And she's been following their games and covering their games for many years now. We talk with her about the Netherlands' expectations in Tokyo this summer, as well as the legacy of Serena Weigman. Obviously, she will leave her role as Netherlands head coach this summer and come across to be the Lionesses, the England Lionesses head coach. And obviously, we'll talk with her as well a little bit about Danielle van der Donk and Jill Roord, both of whom left the club this summer, and Vivian Miedema, who is now the sole Arsenal representation in the Netherlands squad, but quite a few former Arsenal players in there as well. And Alex and I have a really interesting chat with Anne-Marie about Netherlands, about their team at the moment and where they see themselves and whether they can win this thing, having been to the World Cup final in 2019 and winning the European Championships in 2017. But without further ado, Alex and I will now talk to Samantha Lewis about the Matildas. Okay, so joining myself and Alex now with her third appearance on this podcast, which, Samantha, puts you level on the leaderboard of appearances with Leah Williamson. So esteemed company there. But to talk about Australia, the Matildas at this summer's Olympics, we've got from The Guardian, ESPN Australia, Optus, and one of the hosts of the Far Post podcast, Samantha Lewis. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. What an honour to be considered among the rung of Leah Williamson. Wow.
indeed. Kind of becoming our Australian correspondent by proxy. But Australia, obviously, Arsenal don't have an Australian coach anymore, but we do still have three Australian players who will be going to Tokyo this summer. Well, summer for us. I'm conscious I keep saying summer, which showing some hemisphere bias there, but in July and August anyway. And Samantha, I just wondered as a kind of starting point, it's been quite a weird 18 months, well, for everyone, but really for the Matildas as well, because there's kind of at the same time a lot happening and a lot not happening. So I wondered if, just to bring us up to speed, you could kind of do a kind of broad overview of what's happened with the Matildas since they qualified for the Olympics, which was really kind of at the eye of the storm of the pandemic last March.
It absolutely was, yeah. I think the Matildas and Australian football were sort of at the forefront of a lot of the lockdowns, actually, because Australia were meant to fly to Wuhan to play in their Olympic qualifiers against China. And that was when the outbreak first started. And thankfully, Football Australia were quite conscious of the unfolding situation there. And so they decided to rapidly move the Olympic qualifiers to Australia. So we did have home ground advantage in that sense, I suppose. And we skated through that, I think, pretty comfortably. albeit with a tricky draw against a very well-drilled China. But since then, like all other nations in world football, everything stopped. And I think of most of the teams who are going to be competing in Tokyo this year in the women's football tournament, the Matildas went for one of the longest periods not playing a game together. So after qualifying for Tokyo, they went for over 400 days without actually being together in a camp or playing a friendly game, which is a pretty serious amount of time, especially considering how little time international football coaches get with their players to begin with. I think in total, I counted it once, it was about 60 days in total in a full calendar year, which is pretty extraordinary. And on top of that, of course, we had a new coach come in as well, Tony Gustafsson, the Swede, former assistant to the US women's national team. Really exciting appointment, but we didn't actually get to see him do anything for a really long time. So one of the really great things that Football Australia quite quickly organised was trying to get the Matildas to play a number of different friendlies against some really serious top 10 opposition in the lead up to the Olympics. So over the last couple of months, we have had two friendly series. The first series in April was against Germany and the Netherlands, and the second series was against Denmark and Sweden. And over the course of those four games, the Matildas, they got gradually better. You could see that they started to understand what Gustafsson was wanting them to do. He was experimenting with different players. For the first series, there were no players who were actually able to be chosen who were based in Australia because of border situations here. So all of the Matildas that had to be chosen for that first friendly series were either based in Europe or based in the United States in college system. So we did get a couple of players here and there who may not have actually got a look in otherwise. So it sort of became its own little silver lining. And then in the second series, we did have a couple of Australia-based Matildas who were called across as well to feature in those games. We didn't win any of them. I don't think anyone was really surprised that we didn't win any of them, considering the calibre of the opposition. But we did put on, I think, a very impressive performance in a nil-all draw against Sweden, who we're going to be facing in our group, in Group G, alongside the United States and New Zealand. So, yeah, I mean, I think considering the pandemic, considering all the wider circumstances that have affected all the national teams, we're sort of just doing what we can to be at a sort of a peak performance, you know, moment for this group of players heading into Tokyo, and hopefully that'll stand us in good stead.
Yeah, and I think there are going to be quite a lot. I mean, I do think it's quite unique with the Matildas, as you referenced, the border situation. We know that, you know, the big Australian diaspora that's in the WSL still are here in London because they can't go home, which I think is quite an extraordinary circumstance as well. But, you know, you referenced the games, particularly against Germany and Netherlands, which, you know, featured some quite heavy defeats. Was that, do you think, to be expected? And if those games were played in a different circumstance, do you think that they would have been much different? Or do you think that that kind of demonstrates perhaps the gap between Australia and, you know, top five opposition, really?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's important to keep context in mind, especially now. Given what I mentioned before about how long it had been since the Matildas had even been together in a national team camp, you know, that can really affect team chemistry. It can really, particularly with a new coach coming in, a new style, a new philosophy, and then coming up against opposition who have been together in camp with, you know, a lot of players who play together at club level. They've been playing European qualifiers, for example. They've been playing friendlies across Europe because the border situation is a little bit more relaxed there. So the Matildas sort of came into the games against Germany and the Netherlands at a real sort of structural disadvantage in a lot of ways, because their environment and their context just didn't allow them to have the same access to resources or to each other that their opposition did. And so we did see some pretty heavy defeats. It was a 5-2 loss to Germany and a 5-0 loss to the Netherlands. But again, we were experimenting with players. Tony was still meeting them. That was actually the first time that he had met a lot of these players in a national team camp setup. So even just getting familiar with each other again, I think, takes a lot of time. And as I mentioned, over the course of the four friendly games that they played, they did start to develop that chemistry. You could really start to see it on the field, and you could start to see Tony experimenting with different formations, moving different players into different positions, because at that stage, Tokyo was still only going to be an 18-player squad. And so decisions were being made based on who could be really versatile and who could rotate in the case of injuries, for example, or fatigue. But luckily, Tokyo and the International Olympic Committee saw sense, and they decided to expand the squad length to 22, which I personally think should stay, because the amount of football that players are playing already is just extraordinary, and the stress on their bodies is really quite, you know, significant. So over the course of those games, I mean, I think the Matildas showed that they are able to learn quickly. They are adapting to Tony, I think, in leaps and bounds, and they seem to all really be buying into what he is trying to create here, which I think for us, considering our history when it comes to national team coaches, the sort of ups and downs of the last couple of years and the sort of disappointing Women's World Cup performance in 2019, I think it gives a lot of confidence to Matildas fans.
I think we can all agree that the Matildas have a really strong squad, individual players. And obviously with a lot of them coming to the WSL, it kind of, you know, stepped up that level. Obviously, you know, NWSL is a great league, but when you come to the WSL, you know, you're playing against the perennials, Harders, Sam Kerr's among one of the best in the world. You know, it just brings a different kind of style of play. And then you can start competing with the likes of Sweden and all these different countries that have that very similar style of play in Europe. But you know, we talk, I think Tim and I probably agree, you know, Steph Catley, Lydia Williams, Caitlin Ford, amongst other Matildas players are amazing. But do you think this is coming a bit too soon for Tony and the Matildas?
I mean, yes. Yeah, I think it is a bit too soon. And one of the things that I'm personally a little bit worried about is that, particularly here in Australia, our sport media and our football media tends not to be very sort of broad viewing. For example, when a lot of the sort of major mainstream publications here watched the Matildas through France, they were shocked that they lost to Italy, for example. But nobody who had watched the Italian women's national team for a couple of years were really shocked, because they knew that they were fantastic. And so I'm worried that that same sort of tunnel vision is going to affect the way that the media cover the Matildas this Olympics, because I do think that they're probably a bit undercooked. I'm not super convinced they'll make it very far past perhaps the quarterfinals, especially considering the sort of road that is mapped out for them in terms of groups and who could finish where and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you mentioned, Alex, you know, we do have some incredible players. We have some really, really high quality players. Sam Kerr obviously being the cream of the crop there. But I think, you know, when we look outside of this sort of starting 11, this golden generation, that's a term that we use here in Australia to describe this particular team, there is quite a significant drop between that senior team and the generation who is coming through. And I think we sort of see that in the squad selection that Tony has made for the Olympics. There's only a handful of players under the age of 23. And they are really like the best of the best young players that Australia has produced over the last couple of years. Because there is just this Football Australia, our national federation, produced a performance gap report, which found that this particular sort of generation, this squad of Matildas, have just accelerated far beyond the structures that Australian football can actually keep up with. So even though it's great that we do have this fantastic Matildas team at the moment who can go very far, and a lot of them are reaching their peak performance period as well, sort of between the ages of, I guess, 26 and 32, after that, that's, I think, where the big question is going to be asked, is whether consecutive generations of Matildas are going to be able to keep up with the sort of the fantastic results and the energy and the vibe that this current generation has been able to produce.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I think it's one that we can't really answer until maybe 5 years, 7 years from now.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is a bit, you know, a bit of a shame. But you mentioned there kind of the journey that the Matildas have on this. Obviously, the best two third place teams from each group get to go forward and play. So obviously, the order is, you know, New Zealand, Sweden, USA. How do you feel about the order? You know, obviously New Zealand is kind of head in head with Australia in terms of, you know, they had the same complications in terms of COVID. They haven't been together in X amount of time. Would you rather that kind of a level competition and then easily grow into the competition as, you know, obviously the third match is against the US, which they've been pretty strong. You know, they've been playing pretty good games in their warm-up to the Olympics. So how do you feel about that journey just in the group stage?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think this is the best possible draw that the Matildas actually could have been given, because coming off the back of those four friendlies, as I mentioned, we didn't get a win. And I think what the Matildas really need now for their confidence, and what Tony Gustavson needs for his confidence as well, and to get Australian fans and Australian media to really buy into what he's trying to do here, he needs a win. And of all the teams that we're going to be playing in the group stage of Tokyo, New Zealand is the team that we almost certainly are going to get points over, and probably the team that we're going to put a bunch of goals past as well, which I think is going to be really important, specifically for the confidence of Sam Kerr, because she, over the course of those four friendlies, was absolutely marked out of every single game. And this is the problem when you become one of the best players in the world. You all of a sudden have this massive target on your back, and every opposition team is going to put two players on you constantly. They know that you're the threat. And so the Matildas have had to try and find ways around that. They've brought in a couple different kinds of strikers to kind of complement Sam, to move her out into different positions. This is where I think her chemistry with Caitlin Ford comes really, really in handy, because they've been playing together for a long time and they can really bounce off each other and sort of improvise. And we saw that in the Women's World Cup as well. So I think that New Zealand game is going to be a really important sort of foundation game for the Matildas to really assert themselves on the Olympics, to show themselves, to show their fans, to show the other opposition teams that they are here, that they can play, that they are ready to take whatever challenges come their way as well and as brightly as they can. I think moving into the second game against Sweden, again, it's a sort of a progressive, it's almost like a video game, right, to the final boss. So the second stage against Sweden, we played Sweden in a friendly, nil all draw. I don't think either team in that friendly really showed their full hand. I think it was a little bit strategic on the behalf of both of those coaches. And Sweden also didn't have their full strength squad available for that game. And the Matildas were quite fatigued on purpose, so I've been told. So that's sort of difficult to assess how they're going to go based on that game. But I do like the look of Sweden. I think they're going to be one of the dark horses for Tokyo. They tend to do quite well in these kinds of high-pressure tournaments. And they also drew against the USA not too long ago as well. So, you know, heading into then the third and final game of the group against the US, it's a team that the Matildas have only ever beaten once. It was in a friendly in 2017 and it was 1-0. I don't think the USA are infallible. They do have weaknesses, and I think one of the most important things that we have in our arsenal is Tony Gustavson, because that's exactly where he came from, you know, only a year ago. So he's familiar with all the players there. He coached a lot of them through the Women's World Cup wins. He knows their strengths, but he also knows perhaps what their Achilles heels are, and maybe he's able to bring some of that insight into the way the Matildas go for that third game. So I'm pretty confident that we're going to make it into the next stage. It's just about where we finish on the ladder and who we want to be playing in the next round that I think is going to matter.
And you know, we referenced, obviously, there are a few Arsenal players in the Matilda squad, and I just want to talk about a couple of them now. Unfortunately, at Arsenal, we got to see almost none of Steph Catley this season. Lydia was in and out of the team, which we expected because Joe likes to rotate his goalkeepers. But I think, I was actually quite surprised this week. They announced the top three for Arsenal's player of the season, and Caitlin Ford wasn't in the top three, which really surprised me, because most people I speak to agree she has been, since she arrived, one of Arsenal's most consistent performers. Particularly on your podcast, you guys focus a lot on the Australian players in the WSL. What have you made of Caitlin at Arsenal and how she's kind of taken to the league as well as the team?
I mean, she's taken to Arsenal like a duck to water, wouldn't you agree? Like, I remember, yep. Tim, when I was invited onto this pod to talk about Caitlin signing for Arsenal, and you asked me about her sort of style of play, and whether I thought that she would really fit into what Arsenal was as a team. And I was like, absolutely. She is just like crossing the T's and dotting the I's. She is the perfect fit for the kind of style of play, the philosophy of play that Montemurro had instilled in this Arsenal side. And we saw that happen. We saw it come to fruition. And one of the things that I think I was most proud of is that Ford really grew into her game, really grew in confidence and really started to deliver when Arsenal was sort of suffering a couple of serious injuries. She was the player who sort of was maybe milling around on the fringes a little bit, but when she got her opportunity, she took it with both hands and she basically forced herself into that starting 11, even when some of those players returned from injury. So that was really exciting to see. And I think that she absolutely grew as a player. I think she's much more, she's much stronger. She's much more solid on the ball. I think she's smarter in her her sort of one-on-ones in terms of taking players on. I think she's much more clever in terms of using space and bouncing off other players and using them in that kind of 1-2 dynamic, like she does with Sam Kerr, and like I think is going to be really important when it comes to Tokyo as well. But she was never really used as a fullback, which I guess makes sense. But, you know, that was some, one of the sort of the fabulous things about being having such a versatile player like Caitlin Ford at Arsenal is that she does have experience at fullback. And she was named, I think, the best young player at the 2011 Women's World Cup, perhaps. Well, while playing in fullback, and she, there was a game against Brazil where she kept Marta in her pocket and everyone was absolutely stoked because she was 15 and she was just this random Aussie who was just doing a thing. I've loved seeing Ford really, really enjoy her football as well at Arsenal. I think that's one of the most positive takeaways for a lot of these players is that they haven't just come over to the WSL to improve their technical game or to play against high quality sort of opposition or with high quality players, but they also just seem to be really enjoying themselves. And I think that's a really big part of being a successful and a talented footballer is being comfortable, being confident and really enjoying the environment that you're in. So I think that was fabulous to see from Ford. And I, again, like you, I was really disappointed with Cat Lee as well. You know, the series of injuries that she's gone through, it's not just even in her time in Arsenal, but sort of prior to that as well, she'd struggled with quite a few injuries. And she, despite all of that, is I think probably still one of our best fullbacks that we have ever produced in Australian women's football. And it's just such a shame that Arsenal fans weren't able to really see her at full flight, really to see what she can do, because she is the quintessential bombing down the wings, attacking from basically right on the goal line type of fullback. She's incredibly disciplined. She's really smart. She's also very versatile, can play in centre-back roles, can play at fullback, can play as a winger. And she's also just a great person. And I'm sure that a lot of Arsenal fans probably would have seen a lot of the social media banter that her and Lydia Williams got along with, because they are very, very good friends and they were housemates and they've known each other for such a long time and they make videos together. And it's this whole wholesome little friendship that I just adore. So bringing that sort of energy, I think, to the club as well, even if she wasn't playing on the field, I think that probably contributed a lot to the team too.
Yeah, definitely. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Lydia as well, because it's been an interesting season for her, because we had a manager who's very upfront about the fact he likes to rotate goalkeepers. That's quite unique. I'm not sure that Jonas Eidevall, the new coach, will do that. So, and Arsenal have got Manu Zinsberger and Lydia. So I do think it will probably be more of a number one, number two, and it remains to be seen where she'll come in the pecking order. But I kind of noticed that the Matildas had been playing Tegan Micah in goal for some of these friendlies. And obviously there's a bit of future proofing going on there, because Tegan's 23, Lydia's 33. So kind of looking ahead, I think particularly to that World Cup, is there a sense that that is at this stage only future proofing, or is Lydia's place under any immediate threat, do you think?
I don't think Lydia's place is under threat, no. She is the most capped Matilda that we currently have. She is extraordinarily experienced, particularly when it comes to big tournaments like this. And she's also, like, even though she is, you know, getting on along with age, she is aging like a fine wine. I think she's getting better and better as she gets older. Even though she didn't really get the consistent game time that perhaps she was after at Arsenal, I think a lot of her performances were still quite impressive. And she definitely, you know, put herself in contention for a regular starting spot if that was the philosophy that Mona Muro had. But with when it comes to Tegan Mica, she's a really interesting case. And I'm personally really excited because I love talking about Australia's youth players. And Mica was far and away the best goalkeeper in the most recent W League season that we had. She played for Melbourne City. And even though City didn't do particularly well, she was far and away the best goalkeeper. She's only 23. She went through the US college system. She was quite successful there. She's played in Norway. And she got her first sort of real shot under Tony in one of these friendlies. It was the friendly against Sweden. And to make your international debut and to keep a clean sheet against a team that finished third in the most recent Women's World Cup is quite an extraordinary feat for such a young player. And so I think the conversation in a Matilda's context is much more about the number two goalkeeper because compared to Mica, we had Mackenzie Arnold, who plays for West Ham in the WSL. But unfortunately, in two of the friendlies that she played with the Matildas recently, she let in a couple of clangers. There was an own goal that she slapped into her own net. There were a couple of some pretty basic, I guess, goalkeeping errors that would have put a seed of doubt, I think, into Gustafsson's mind and really inspired him to bring Mica in and to see what she could do. And like Ford at Arsenal, Mica took her opportunity with both hands and she's been rewarded for it by being the second choice goalkeeper called into this Olympic squad. So I think it's definitely partially future-proofing. I think she is absolutely the natural heir to the senior Matilda's number one goalkeeper spot. But I think also she's just a really talented young goalkeeper and she's going to learn a lot from this experience. And I hope that she gets minutes against perhaps a New Zealand or a Sweden because we've seen what she can do and she can do it really well.
And we talk a lot about that gap between the golden generation, as you say, and all the younger players coming up, whether it be through the college system. But to continue that, you know, after the collegiate system into kind of the professional and then into the Matildas, you know, the Olympics, the World Cups, all these competitions, do you think that players should stay in the WSL?
So when Tony first took over as Matilda's coach, he was asked about this question because it was sort of in the midst of this European exodus, as we called it, where we had a lot of Matildas moving across to Europe, joining the WSL, even joining other European leagues as well, Sweden, Norway, some in Germany. And he was asked, you know, what he thought about it, whether he thought it was a good idea, whether we should all sort of be encouraging more young Australian players to pursue opportunities in Europe. And his answer, I think, was really important and really sort of lovely. He said, you know what, a player's path depends on the player. A player could go to Europe and they could have a fantastic time and learn a lot, but similarly, a player could go to Europe and not learn anything. They could actually sometimes go backwards. And we saw some of that happen actually with a handful of Australian players. Jenna McCormick, for example, went to Spain and she really did not like the experience at all. And she came back to the W League quite quickly. Alex Chidiak is another good example. She went to Atletico Madrid. She was one of the first Matildas really to make this sort of foray out into the wilderness of Europe. But she, again, a sort of combination of injuries and I guess squad selection just meant that she very rarely got picked and she didn't really play for the 2 or 3 years that she was there. So I think it all depends on the player. It depends on what the player wants to do, what they want to work on in their game, what they're looking for, and how their expectations are matched by the reality of the situation when they get there as well. You know, we talk about the WSL as being this fantastic, fully professional league, but then you hear stories of a Birmingham City or a Bristol, you know, clubs that are not really reaching those same kinds of standards as an Arsenal or a Chelsea or a City or even recently, you know, conversation about Manchester United's women's team. They're not giving the appropriate training facilities and you're seeing this huge exodus of players from that club of all clubs, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on the player. And I think what Tony has brought to this group and what he's trying to instill in the rest of the Australian women's football community is that your path is your path. If you don't want to go to Europe, that's fine. You can go somewhere else. There are so many other places that you can play. You can stay in Australia. We've got Alex Chidiak, for example, has decided to come back to Australia and then go to Japan. because there's a new fully professional women's league starting up there and she wants to focus on that part of her game. And that's great. If that's what the player wants, that's fabulous. And so empowering players to make those kinds of decisions, to value their mental health, to value the rest of their lives as well outside of just football. You know, it's great to play for a fabulous club, but if you hate where you live, if you're not enjoying the weather, if you don't enjoy the culture, that all sort of folds into your performances on the field in one way or another as well. So, yeah, I mean, my answer is basically, it depends.
And just as a final one before we let you go, Sam, you know, we kind of said that a feeling that maybe, not least because of the situation, that this tournament might be a bit early for the Matildas. Is there a sense, both for the Matildas and maybe for Tony Gustafsson as well, that this is like about building towards 2023? And do you think this group will mainly be the one that we'll see in the 2023 World Cup?
I think this is absolutely a case of building towards 2023. 2023 is going to be the most important moment, not just for Australian women's football, but for Australian football for a very, very, very long time. And now that we know that we're hosting it, all the work has started, all the people are being recruited, there's a lot of foundations being laid. That's the tournament where the Matildas really need to make a statement. To be able to win a World Cup on home soil is an extraordinary feat. And if they were to do that, even if they were to get close to that, it would really revolutionise the game here and across Asia and also across the Pacific, across the OFC, who we're co-hosting with New Zealand. So I think this is definitely part of that process. And Gustafsson, Sam Kerr, all the players who you speak to, they all are talking about process. This is all part of this multi-year project that Gustafsson has been brought in specifically to try and manage through. So we are seeing a couple of young players being blooded in the Tokyo Olympics. We've got Tegan Micah. We've got, for example, Kara Cooney Cross, who is a young sort of prodigy. She's 19. We've got the young Mary Fowler, who's 18, currently playing in France. So we do have a couple of talents here and there that are being given these opportunities and given these experiences, because there is the vision within Australian football that these are going to be the players that lead this team forward. When it comes to, I guess, the next, 2 years, when I look forward to our next sort of tournament next year is the Women's Asian Cup, which is supposedly being hosted in India. I'm not sure if that's going to go ahead considering the coronavirus situation. But I think that Asian Cup is going to be even more experimental than what Tokyo is, because Tokyo for me, I think, is it's a tournament where Gustafsson needs to prove himself in some ways to a lot of people. And so I think because of that, his squad selection has been a little bit safe. I think if there were no expectations on the tournament, which there wouldn't be in the Women's Asian Cup because we already qualify for the World Cup afterwards as hosts, we don't actually need to go out and absolutely demolish all of the opposition in that specific tournament. And so Gustafsson has the license to be a bit more experimental, to bring in some more players, to blood them, to see what they can do and how they can grow over the course of the next year leading into 2023. So absolutely, I look at the Matildas over the next couple of years in the context of the next Women's World Cup, because that is going to be the thing ultimately that matters to this team, to this generation of players, and to the game more generally here.
Samantha, thank you so much for your insight as ever on all things Matildas Australia, and thank you for being our de facto Australian correspondent. I am certain we will have cause to talk again on this podcast very soon, maybe after the gold medal in Tokyo. So best of luck in Tokyo, and thanks so much again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Yes, no, I will absolutely come back on and debrief when we win the gold medal. That'll be really fun for me.
Looking forward to it. Really big thanks to Samantha there for her insights on all things Matildas as usual, and I am sure that we will have cause to have her back on the podcast again very shortly. But now, as promised, Alex and I will talk to Anne-Marie Posma, who is a Dutch journalist covering the Netherlands national team for quite some time now, and we talked to her a little bit about the Arsenal representation, the former Arsenal representation as well in that squad, as well as Netherlands' chances this summer.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Okay, joining us now, as promised, the absolute expert on all things Netherlands, Dutch women's football, and particularly the Netherlands women's team, Anne-Marie Posma. Second appearance on the podcast. Anne-Marie, welcome back, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been an honour.
And I'll let you in on, well, it's not going to be a secret anymore, but the last episode you were on remains the most downloaded Arsenal Women Askcast we've had yet in the kind of 2.5 years we've been doing this. So big expectations of you, Anne-Marie. We've got a lot of Dutch listeners, put it that way.
Okay. Well, I'm still waiting for the money.
We'll write you a royalties check for that. Before we kind of crack on with talking about Netherlands at Tokyo and the Olympics and all of that, obviously there's only one Arsenal player in the Dutch squad officially now, having like a mini Dutch exodus. Was Jules Roord and Daniel van der Donk leaving the club this summer. I just wanted to pick up with DVD first and just ask whether you were surprised to see her move to Lyon and how you think she'll get on there.
Well, I wasn't surprised because obviously the rumors had been there for a while and she's been playing for Arsenal for a long time. So I think if you look at it in a sportive way, she's ready to move on. And I think she wants to, she's basically talking about this final step, you know, to a bigger club than Arsenal. I do understand you don't think there is a bigger club. but it's been in her head, and I know if there's something that she thinks about, she wants to achieve that. I am surprised because, you know, we've all been talking about the Premier League, like Women's Premier League in the Netherlands, and it's been big for so many years. And then suddenly it all seems like, I don't know, it's falling apart or Arsenal is falling apart. And then you see these players leave and you think, are they actually leaving? Because, I don't know. It's just a pity, I think, for a club like Arsenal with this reputation. But, they want a little bit more. And I think Arsenal lacks... they're not very ambitious at the moment. Well, and Dutch players, they all seem to say the same, you know, Roord, van der Donk, Miedema, like, what do they want and where are they going with us? And if they don't give the right signal, then, well, you know, you're going to look somewhere else. And Olympique Lyon, well, it's a very big club, so I do understand that if you get that offer, you don't say no. She's terrible in her French, though. So she's she's been telling me that. She's like, slightly worried about my French. She doesn't speak any French. but that's the only thing. I mean, she's very excited about it.
Yeah. I spoke to her about the French lessons. She said to me she's kind of on Duolingo at the moment, but she doesn't think she'll properly be able to start the lessons until she's over there. And on the ambition point, I mean, we interviewed her a couple of weeks ago and she said much the same thing. She said, I know that Lyon will try to win the Champions League. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that was quite telling and really cut through. Another player who left Arsenal this summer, probably in different circumstances because DVD had been here a long time and really established herself. And I do think that it was kind of maybe maybe mutually agreeable, like in terms of DVD's been here for 6 years. I do think it was probably time for something different from Arsenal, as well. Whereas Gilles was only really here for 2 years. And I think we only saw flashes of Gilles Roud's talent at Arsenal. And I think she ran into maybe a similar problem she ran into at Bayern, in terms of just the team being quite crowded, and I'm not sure she ever really fitted in tactically at Arsenal. But what about Gilles moving to Wolfsburg? Do you see that as a good move for her? And I guess to tie into that, what's her status at the moment in the Netherlands team? Because she does seem to be playing more, starting more games.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was asked to move to Wolfsburg, I think a year ago ago already, and then she said no. And then they hired this German trainer, but he's been working for FC Twente, Tommy Stroot, and he really wanted her to move to Wolfsburg. So he asked her father, like, hey, can you help me out? You know, I really want Jill on the team. And I know it's been said a lot, but it is true, like, due to COVID, due to virus, I mean, Wolfsburg is closer to her home, to her family. So that kind of made her think, like, maybe I do want to move closer to home, you know, also because of Brexit and all things going on. And again, it's the same story. I mean, she started thinking about it. And when you start thinking about something, about this new adventure, but then the club that you're already in doesn't try to keep you, you know, you start thinking about the other thing more and more, and it will become more attractive, and you think about, well, maybe I should move, you know. So I know she felt that way and started seeing it as this fresh new start, and then seeing the trainer move there, that she knows him very well, and a couple of the Dutch players, So also, it didn't surprise me. It's just a shame for Arsenal. And I wonder, like, I don't know, you know that better than me, but I wonder what they actually tried to keep her, you know? I don't know if they offered her a new contract or anything, or just sit around the table with her. And then, yeah, when it comes to her status, it's interesting because you mentioned the problem she had at the beginning with Arsenal. It seems like she has that problem every time she comes in a team and it seems too crowded for her to fit in. And it all kind of, like, her status in the national team, it's the opposite at the moment, because she earned her spot. She actually earned her spot. And she started at the World Cup, where she left a really, really good impression, which is funny because she moved from number 12 to 19. She asked for a different number, right? Because she didn't want to be the 12th player, as you mentioned, mostly we connect the 12th player with the fans. So she asked for number 19. And now she's a number 6 for the Olympics. So she has her spot in the team, which is great. And she's very, very important to the team. I remember we lost against Italy 1-0. And it was a team without Ward, without Miedema, and without Martens. And we weren't able to do anything. And then the next game, it was Norway. We played at home. And Ward scored, Miedema scored twice, Van der Donk scored, Martens scored. So, you know, that kind of says it all. She's very important. And I think also Wiegman created a spot for her. She was very used to play with the right wingers, like Shanice van der Sande and Bedestein. And now she uses Ward as a right winger, but she has a lot of freedom. You know, she can be very flexible, moving in the middle and in the 16 and into the box. So, yeah, she how do you say that? She made her usable or something? Yeah.
Play to her strengths a lot. I do agree with that. I particularly enjoyed watching Wiegman's tactics using Jill on the wing for the Dutch, because obviously for Arsenal she plays a bit more of a central role in the midfield. I know Joe was trying to get her to, like, play off of Viv, but I think that wing role that kind of Wiegman created for her to allow her that bit more freedom that she needs, I think, for her play has been really interesting. But we have talked about, you know, players moving, obviously Jill, Dan as well to Lyon. But then you have other players, like, I know Dekker went to Portugal. I did not see that coming, first of all. and then now when going to Chelsea, and then even like Spitzer went back to the Netherlands not too long ago. So like, do you think, and obviously with Serena Wiegman leaving and a new coach coming in, do you think all these changes are going to reflect well on the national team?
Well, I do think so, because I think players start to think more about, you know, that's still a big difference in the women's game and the men's game. They also think about their mental health is a pretty strong word, but they do think more about staying close to family, relatives, partners. So if they feel comfortable, it will show on the national team, right? You can see them just glow. I mean, look at Lieke Martens. She admitted she'd been struggling in Barcelona in the beginning. Well, actually for 2 years. I mean, even since the World Cup, when she was injured so many times. But she had this amazing season. I mean, it worked out so well. She's been playing really well. And it shows in the national team. Like, she didn't play well for a while, but now she's this big star again, maybe even bigger than 2017. I mean, she's obviously grown as a player, more mature as well. So I do think it will reflect on the Dutch team. But I also think there are some players who will see the Olympics as their not their last time to shine, but kind of like another highlight. Like, well, if we shine here, we've got the Euros, the World Cup, and the Olympics. And then, you know, a player like Anouk Dekker, not sure how long she will stay on the national team. Maybe after the Olympics, it will be herself saying like, okay, you know, it's been enough. And then, yeah, Sherida Spitzer, she's still important for the team. You know, she has these killer free kicks and taking all the penalties. But yeah, there are also new players in line on that position. So we'll see. It's going to be, for sure, it's going to be really interesting what's going to happen over the next year. Yeah, moving to the Euros in your country, actually.
Excited. No, yeah. We get to move on from the men's now, and then we get to move on to the next women's Euros, yeah. All in England. sorry, Tim. the next question was around kind of a particular game that I was interested in when the Dutch played Spain. Obviously, that was 1-0. But that was kind of the first time that I saw the Netherlands struggle a lot compared to after the World Cup. Obviously, I think the projection just kept going upwards, and Serena Wiegman solidified the team that she had. You know, I mentioned Jill, like, she solidified that role, and it worked really well. But Spain was kind of the first time that the Netherlands really, really struggled against an opposition team. So kind of just wanted to get your thoughts on that, and kind of post that match as well, and before the Olympics, how you're seeing the team right now.
Yeah, well, I think it was very good that they played against Spain, and I think it was really good that they lost in the way that they did, because it kind of revealed a lot. I have to say, like, Spain, I mean, not many people know that, right? They see the match on TV and they criticize the Netherlands, but Spain has an amazing team. And then the next question is like, oh, but they're not on the Olympics. Well, that's just a lack of knowledge, because they didn't qualify for Olympics. It's a whole different story. But Spain is one of the best teams at this moment. The fact that they lost wasn't very surprising to me. But the way they did, I know Wiegman struggled with it, because it was the way they pressured Spain. They didn't know how to pressure Spain. And I think also, if you have another confrontation coming up with the United States, if at the Olympics, they will have the same problem. You know, how do you pressure a team like that? That's so, they have so many skilled players. And Spain, they all played together at Barcelona, you know, and it was almost impossible to defend that team, because they, and in some positions, I think the Netherlands was also a bit too slow. Like, they were, Spain was just too fast, you know, 1-2 touches, and then the Netherlands didn't know what to do, and they were all looking at each other like, oh, are you going to put pressure on her? Then I will do this, but then you're already too late. So, I mean, they're in pre-camp now. They're probably still talking about the match. If I know Wiegman very well, and I do, he'll be mentioning the match against Spain and against Italy. And she will tell the players, like, so what do we do? You know, what's the plan? And it comes down to more practice and more, yeah, just backing each other up, I guess. I remember one point, I think it was end of the first half, if I remember correctly. It was just everyone on his own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Van de Donk was running, Spitzer was running, Shaki Groene was running, but they weren't really working together. And I think if they, yeah, if you train and you practice and you achieve this level of let's work together, we pressure in groups of three or four, and we know when, we know how, we know when to move forward, you know, don't stay at your own half, like dare to move, push it forward.
Yeah.
You can beat a team like Spain, even in the United States. I do believe that.
Yeah, yeah. And what's my next question, Anne-Marie, was going to be, it's interesting you talk about that Spain game, and yeah, I watched it, and you know, I think it's clear that Spain are like the team in Europe that's really coming up, and a lot of people have known that for a year or two, and Italy are getting better as well, I think. But you know, for in terms of the expectation for this tournament, because the Netherlands have been, you know, the prominent team in Europe. They won the last Euros. They got to the World Cup final last time around. What are your kind of expectations from this tournament? And in terms of, I guess, what do you feel Netherlands' status is now among, like, Europe's best teams?
Well, I mean, we've all witnessed that if they have a good day, you know, then the Netherlands is still a really, really strong team. I don't think as strong as Spain yet, because there is also the problem, like Alex mentioned, like you have players all around the world, or, you know, we had five players at Arsenal at some point, which is pretty good for the national team. And we will have the same at Wolfsburg next season, you know. But when everyone is somewhere else, you really need these moments as a national team to train together. And then you need a really skilled coach to make it work. Which Wiegman is, but they're not as good as Spain because they have like 8-9 players playing for Barcelona. But if you compare it to the teams at the Olympics, I think they have a really good chance of semifinal. I mean, if you look at, I think Team GB, I don't know what you guys think about it, because they're not the same collective or performing as a team, but you have the United States. I think Japan is always dangerous. Never underestimate Japan. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the group of the Netherlands, you have Brazil, China, and Zambia. And Brazil is kind of struggling also with in between generations. And China might be the most dangerous one. Because they're really strong together. And I read this crazy article on the FIFA.com that they, during COVID, they couldn't play many matches. But they had this training camp that lasted for 130 days, and in which they ran every day. They ran at least 10 kilometers. I was like, I mean, if you have 11 Chinese players being fit, being strong, and being able, like, they never quit, they never give up. might be the hardest challenge in their group.
As long as they stop you from scoring, then it's a problem.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the Netherlands, their strongest point, their strength, is that they have so many players that can score a goal. Like, they're not relying on Miedema, they're not relying on Martens, and they're not relying on one person. If you see the match against Belgium, they had six different goal scorers. Against Norway, they had six different goal scorers. So, and I do think we still have to... No, maybe not as the United States. Yeah, I'm going to say it. We have... I think our attack is stronger than the United States.
Mm-hmm.
With Ward, with Miedema, and with Lieke Martens. The way she plays now, Lieke Martens is an absolute star.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's valid. I think it, like... Again, Arsenal bias possibly showing here. I think any attack with Vivian Miedema in it can you know, confidently put itself among the best. Another quite broad general question. You know, one of the things that's really defined Netherlands in these tournaments for people who aren't from Netherlands anyway is this like great sea of orange, particularly in 2017 when the Euros was hosted there, and this kind of we're used now to like Netherlands games selling out quite regularly in good sized stadiums and things like that. Obviously we're not going to have that in Tokyo. It looks like the games will be behind closed doors, but even if they weren't, it's just not going to be possible for that type of fanfare. But how much do Netherlands fans really care about this tournament? Because with the Olympics, I kind of find it really, in terms of like football at the Olympics, it really varies from country to country in terms of its importance. How important do you think this is put against, say, the World Cup and the Euros for Netherlands fans?
Netherlands fans in general, it's not. If you look at the football fans, like the women's football fans, it is. I mean, we were supposed to have a match, a friendly match against South Africa. And sadly, South Africa had 5 corona cases in the team. So, that sucked for them. And then they decided instead of a match, they would do like an open practice, like an open training. And there were like thousands, there were a maximum of 1,000 people, fans, that were allowed at the KNVB in Zeist. And they were all there. Like they managed to organize an event like that in three days. And there were 1,000 people watching it. And of course it was family and friends, you know, but it was so, I don't know, it was like a great atmosphere. And there were kids wearing jerseys with Martens on the back and Van den Donk, and they were all waving like, hey, Shanice van der Sande, you know. And I don't know, it made me really happy that whatever they, you know, what they created in 2017 has not faded. Where everyone was a little bit skeptical, would it stay? Will they keep their popularity or how will it go? And then it only got bigger, you know, it got bigger during the World Cup. So I think that the people caring about women's football, they will see the match. Even if we have 2 channels that show the friendly matches here, and one is like more an obvious channel, is like the number 8 or something on telly, and you have like over 100,000 people watching or more. But then even on the other channel, which is more hidden, we also do have like a lot of people watching the match. So yeah, if it comes to football fans, like people watching the Euros for men, no, they won't care. But again, they don't know how big it is. They don't know it. Like, they don't know. You have different rules for the men's at the Olympics. You know, you got to be 20 up to 23, you're not older and stuff like that. And you don't have that rules, those rules for the women. Like, it's a really, if you win the golden medal, it's a really high achievement. I am slightly worried, like you said, that if you look at the matches we lost against Italy, against Spain, they were all away. And we won the matches at home. And we've said since 2017, this team works really well when they have Dutch fans. Mm-hmm. On the side, when they have their family, when they have their friends. And you could see that every time they played home, I think it was against Norway, there were thousands of fans welcoming, and they were all waving, you know, to their relatives. And it was fun to watch it, but it makes you think, ooh, how are they gonna cope in an empty stadium far away in Japan? They only have each other, and not even always each other, because they're alone in their hotel room. Not you know, they can sit at the pool, but then there's nothing else. That makes me worried. I don't know how they're gonna. Yeah, but if you look at their quality, semi-final at least.
Yeah, I'm always jealous of Dutch fans.
You are?
I always wish I was Dutch.
Really?
Pretty much every week I think about it at least once. I was like, I really wish I was Dutch.
But do you think it's extraordinary, the Dutch fans looking at the women's team here?
Yeah, because you don't see that support as equally. Because like, even we can probably say that it's definitely not equal between the men and the women. But I mean, Dutch fans, even in the World Cup, I mean, that was amazing. There was one whole section, it was just orange, and you could hear them all over the pitch. But just like, it's what I like about Dutch fans in general, it's the vibe that they give. It's so much joy just to watch football, be it men, be it women. It's just the pride of watching your national team playing the beautiful game of football. It's just, it's a feeling that you don't really get in a lot of countries. Mm-hmm. I do have like Dutch jerseys. Like I have everything. I'm ready to go for the next world, like for the next Euros. But yeah, I do. I think once a week, I do wish I was Dutch.
For that. I wish I was British. I have my shirt behind me on the wall. So just, but I mean, it might come right when the Euros will be in England. Don't you think?
I would hope so. Yeah.
Don't you think it will have the same effect as it had here in 2017?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. I'm hoping for it at least.
Yeah, really hope so. Really hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then with Wiegman, you have the perfect person that will, create that as well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But yeah, we spoke about kind of the difference between the men and the women, because obviously when Sweden beat the US in the semifinal, that's never going to happen in the World Cup, for example, but it happened in the Olympics. Obviously, it's not the same caliber in terms of, I think, mentality for the US side. It's not like when they're in a World Cup, that's their home. You look back at it. In the Olympics, they're still the US, but again, it wasn't penalties, but Sweden did beat them. But yeah, these Olympics, kind of going on your expectations for the Netherlands team, should they confront a US in a semifinal, for example, what do you think it's going to happen? Do you think it's going to be more down to, the heart of playing and wanting to beat them and kind of get the revenge from the last World Cup, or are they going to struggle just a bit more of that mentality side? Like you said, it is behind closed doors, and the Netherlands have struggled with that previously. So kind of what do you expect if they have to match up to this?
Well, in terms of revenge, Dutch people can be really feisty if they want to get their revenge. Van der Donk, she will fight. But we played against them, last year and not long ago, and we lost again. It was a close call still, but the US, I don't know. I watch them now a couple of times live, and they're so strong and they're so fit. And if you want to come to that fitness level, I don't know, there's something else, It's like you have all these national teams and then there's the US. And I know they're beatable, and I know Holland can beat them. And I also know that when it comes to the Olympics, there must be a plan. I mean, they're in Japan right now. And when the Netherlands are preparing for a tournament, they do it well. Like, it won't be if they lose or they drop out in groups phase, whatever. Worst case scenario, of course, then it won't be the preparation. There's just, it will be because something is wrong in the team or I don't know. But Serena Wiegman is all about prepping with her staff members, and she will have a plan to beat the United States this time. She will. And it comes, I think, maybe 50%, just about having the guts. Like, don't look up to them. Like I'm still doing a little bit, like I'm putting them really high, like this is the United States. But if you're a player, don't do that. Just think about them, like we can beat them. And like I said, if you put Miedema next to Martens, and you have Ward, you have the creativity, you have the goal score. Once you get the ball up there, you can create many chances. But if you play as defensive, like the World Cup final, I mean, we had Bedestein as a striker. We had Martens limping because of her toe. So we were kind of like disabled. And then Miedema behind Bedestein. I think they learn from it and think, well, we just got to stick to our own plan. Yeah.
In Serena Wiegman, we trust.
Yeah, I do.
And then, like staying on the topic of Serena, do you think that's going to give a little extra incentive for the players to kind of send her off on a high Do you think that's just going to play that little extra push, maybe in a game against the US in a semifinal and a final, when they're kind of low on energy and that mental strength? Do you think when they think about that, is that going to push them just that little bit further that they need?
Yeah, I don't think it's the first thing that comes to mind. I think the first thing that comes to their minds is that this will be their first time being on the Olympics, you know. I spoke to the press manager this morning as I missed my call with Viviana Miedema. So I talked to her a little bit and she said, you know, all the girls, they're so proud to be walking around in their, we call it Team NL jerseys, like Team Netherlands. They're so proud of it, you know. So that will be the main thing, like, hey, here we are. This is our debut on the Olympics. And then the next thing, they're not thinking about Wiegman leaving because they leave, you know, they want to leave it until the tournament is over. But yeah, I'm sure they're thinking about, like, let's give her a send off and do the best we can also for her. But I think the main vibe right now is let's present ourselves, you know, let's present ourselves. Yeah, here we are.
Yeah. And, you know, just to kind of close out, I was hoping we'd close out with a question on Serena, which Alex definitely handled there. But I wanted to kind of close with a question about looking forward to her replacement, Mark Parsons from Portland Thorns. You know, it seemed like quite a lengthy manager search, which I think is kind of fine because there was plenty of time to do it. And I know that Mark has, you know, he's from Flow Sports, right? Who Arsenal know very well because that's where Joe Montemurro came from and where most of Arsenal's Dutch players are signed to. Were you surprised by that appointment? And what do you make of Mark Parsons being the replacement for Serena?
Well, yeah, I was surprised. I mean, I got a phone call from the radio station, I think half an hour after his announcement, and they were like, yeah, so we need a quote from you and it's got to be in 30 seconds and it's about Mark Parsons. I was like, okay, give me a second. And I had to look everything up. I was like, who is this guy? How old is he? Does he have a family? Where is he from? What did he do? So I was surprised. And I had no idea that he was connected to Flow Sports. You know, once the things get rolling, you're like, oh, okay, now I understand the connection and stuff. So, I've been following their search very closely. And I know the length wasn't a problem. It was just the way they did it. It was so incredibly clumsy. Like, you have no idea. I was like, I didn't get it anymore. I was like, what are you doing? Who are you searching for? Are you searching for a man, for a woman? And I don't think like they even had the answer, you know? So that's why it took so long. And then I don't think it's bad that he's a man. I think the most important thing that he has experience in the women's game. So if I look at that, I'm pretty confident in what he's going to do. I slightly worry because like he's going to be working for the Portland Thorns another couple of months. So I don't know how he's going to combine it. I don't know. You know, he was joking about the time difference. Like we were joking at the beginning of the podcast, but honestly, how are you going to do it? You know, you're going to get up and watch Dutch players play in Europe and then do your job at Portland Thorns. So I don't know if it's going to be, if he's going to be distracted. First few months, but he's young. I think he's young. He seems prepared. Like he seems like a guy who wants also to be prepared, and he's British. So I think he wants to win the Euros, which is important. You know, it's going to be an honor for him, but also to lift up the trophy with the Dutch team. Yeah. So I'm curious. It was just the way it went. It was so ridiculous and weird. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And
I don't know how you, I'm sorry, I don't know, like, he's coming there all by himself. Yeah. Like, he's not going to bring a staff member because they already arranged it for him. Like, they choose this, a Dutch trainer, like, she's amazing, Jessica Torney. She's really good and she knows everything about the talents coming up, you know, next generations. But she was there positioned and then they choose him. So he's going to be here all alone.
Yeah, and that's interesting, actually. And something similar is happening with Jonas Eidevall, who's managing Arsenal. He's keeping all of the staff in place. Definitely for the moment. But he's kind of saying that he wants to do that because he wants to get a better feel for the place, and those coaches know the players and everything. And whether that changes, like maybe next summer, maybe when he's had a bit more time, I'm not sure. Mm. But maybe that will happen with Mark as well. Maybe particularly while he's doing that interim kind of between two roles, maybe it just makes sense to leave that level of expertise. But I mean, I take it, being British, with the Dutch national squad, there shouldn't be much of a language barrier.
there won't be a problem.
I mean,
we had this Dutch trainer a couple of years ago. I mean, he was Dutch, and they had more of a communication problem than I think they would have with any English speaking trainer. So, yeah.
Yeah, and similar for Arsenal as well, having a Swedish coach. Again, absolutely no problem there. But Amory, we've taken quite a bit of your time, but that was really, really interesting. Really, really grateful for your insights as ever. And I am sure that we will have cause to talk to you again on this podcast. So thanks so much for joining us, Amory.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Big thanks to my co-host, as usual, Alex Ibaceta, as well as our guests, Samantha Lewis and Amory Posma. And I think you can see why they've been on the podcast more than once. There are very few people who know more about Australia and Netherlands than those two. And again, I'm sure we'll see them again on the podcast at some point in the upcoming season. Like I said, this is a two-parter about the four teams that have Arsenal representation at the Olympics. So we'll be back later this week, and Pippa and I will speak to Rich Laverty about Team GB. Lots of Arsenal interest there, with Leah Williamson, Lotta Wubben-Moy, and of course Nikita Paris in the Team GB squad, but also the kind of surprise, I guess, exclusion of Jordan Nobbs and Beth Mead from that squad. So we'll talk to Rich a little bit about that, and then I will be talking to Sean Carroll, who is an English journalist based in Tokyo, and we'll be talking to Sean about Japan, the hosts, of course, who have Mana Iwabuchi, who signed for the club this summer. So we'll talk to Sean a little bit about Mana, a little bit about Japan and their chances, but also maybe a bit about the wider context of the games in Tokyo, and certainly hosting them during coronavirus, during a very curious time for the world. So we hope that you enjoyed this episode. We hope that you will download and listen to that episode as well. And as ever, thank you from the bottom of my heart, from Alex's heart, from Pippa's heart, for continuing to download and support this podcast. We really believe in this content. We really believe that there's a demand for it and that it's important. But that only becomes true while you're downloading and listening. So thank you so much. If you feel inclined, please do leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and make it clear that you're reviewing the Arsenal Women Askcast, because it all helps, and hey, it's nice to be nice. And on that note, thank you, goodbye, take care.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.